Good morning.
My name is Patty Rose, and I represent Christopher Young in this appeal. I'd also like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Four, all right.
This case is also an employment discrimination case, but before I turn to the employment issues, I'd like to focus some of the court's attention on the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim, which was also dismissed below. In that situation, the trial court found lack of jurisdiction based simply, it appears, on the fact that Mr. Young filed a workers' comp claim arising out of one incident that occurred in the course of his employment.
Can I ask you a question about that claim?
Sure.
Does it arise out of the same conduct as the discrimination claims?
It arises out of basically the same conduct.
If the discriminatory aspect of that conduct was found wanting on summary judgment, would that also, if the summary judgment was correct on those other claims, then would that also defeat the negligent infliction emotional distress claim, setting aside the L&I argument?
No, it wouldn't. As you know from one of the Division I cases that's fairly close to this case, Chape versus Men's Warehouse, that case went to both a jury on alternative claims of negligent infliction of emotional distress, as well as...
Well, they're both available, but if there isn't enough evidence to support any of the discrimination claims, can there still be sufficient evidence to support the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim?
Yes, because they're totally different causes of action with different elements. The requirement for his NIED claim is simply that the county breached a duty that they owed him, independent of the duty to prevent a workplace.
To not discriminate, right?
But that's not the basis of his duty.
The duty that you claim was breached in the negligent infliction of emotional distress.
The duty that we're claiming here is the public policy and duty recognized in Washington law in McCarthy versus DSHS to provide a safe work environment for all its employees to the reasonable extent possible. And when there's foreseeable risk of harm, the county would have a duty to take measures to alleviate that.
What evidence do you contend is in the record to support the claim that the county breached that duty?
In this case, Mr. Young had an experience early in his employment experience with Mr. Williams. He has characterized that consistently as an assault. There was an interaction where Mr. Williams literally pulled down his arm across a counter, causing injury. And
is there other evidence besides that incident?
Yes, thereafter, there was other aggressive physical encounters between them, including a March 2012 incident where Mr. Williams literally impeded Mr. Young in leaving a cubicle and stood over him in a very aggressive way and prevented him from exiting his cubicle, and then followed him all the way down the hallway in a very physically aggressive way, to the point where people observing that incident said they thought there might be violence because Mr. Williams was standing so close to him and being aggressive and physically assaultive to him, all the way to the point where the county investigated that issue on Mr. Young's claim that there was abusive behavior. And the decision maker who did the investigation there, Mr. Salyer, concluded that Mr. Williams's conduct was inappropriate, knowing that Mr. Young had already had a predisposition for feeling anxious and claustrophobic and having panic attacks arising out of prior treatment by Mr. Williams. So they were on notice and had an awareness that Mr. Young had emotional distress, had extreme forms of emotional distress that were evident at the workplace because of the confrontations he had had with Mr. Williams in the past, and yet they persistently failed to take action to limit their interactions, to prevent those kind of interactions from occurring. And there was another interaction even after Mr. Young's then lawyer raised the issue and said, you're creating an unsafe work environment for him, where Mr. Williams also confronted him in a very small space and grabbed something and physically prevented Mr. Young from leaving his workplace. So in each case, there was a growing aggression after this assault incident in August or September of 2010.
Does the assault incident alone support an IED claim?
I don't think, it's not an IED claim. It's a negligent infliction, not an intentional infliction of emotional
distress. That's what I meant to say, yeah.
The issue there, Mr. Young would concede that if the single traumatic injury that occurred was covered by workers' comp,
I see.
Was the sole basis of his emotional distress,
then it would be duplicated.
He believes those would be, and that's the county's basically their argument, is that this was a single traumatic injury and that all his emotional distress flowed from that incident. And Mr. Young's position is, and subsequently rising to the level of a PTSD diagnosis. And Mr. Young's position is that, as in virtually all the cases I've been able to find, I think with the exception of this Rothwell case, which is very distinguishable, the courts have refused to find a PTSD as an occupational disease or arising out of a single traumatic injury. So, and I'll try to address the discrimination issues
okay.
of fun
right.
hearing the county's position.
Thank you. So you have 4 minutes remaining in rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Erin Overby on behalf of King County, the respondent in this case. And we are asking that the Court affirm the trial court in all respects with respect to her decision not to allow a very late amendment to the complaint that added new claims. All the race-based claims, the retaliation claims, and also the dismissal of the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim.
And can you address the latter and explain why all of the claim necessarily arises out of the one traumatic incident as opposed to the other incidents counsel described in her answer?
Well, I think part of the answer is found in the information provided by Mr. Young's own therapist. She diagnosed him with PTSD with some anxiety issues, and the way the diagnostic criterion works, he could only have PTSD if there was some traumatic event, and the traumatic event that he told her about was the 2010 assault.
If he has the PTSD, though, can he suffer negligent infliction of emotional distress by continuing conduct by his supervisor that fails to take into account that he suffers from that condition and that his behavior will cause him distress?
I'm not sure if I correctly understood the question.
Well, Mr. Williams is at some point aware that Mr. Young has a PTSD diagnosis, or at least the people that supervise him are.
And I think that's an important distinction, Your Honor.
Behavior by Mr. Williams after that diagnosis is alleged to have caused Mr. Young distress.
And I don't think that that's borne out in the diagnostic criterion that he's relying on to support his claim. One of the things you need in a negligent infliction claim is some kind of diagnosis, and the diagnosis from his therapist doesn't relate to the things that you were just directed to. She didn't consider, and he didn't even discuss with her, the grabbing of papers out of his hand or the being caught up in a cubicle and having difficulty.
We're across purposes here because you're focusing on what precipitates the diagnosis, and I'm asking you questions about once you have the diagnosis, can you continue to suffer additional distress because of ongoing behavior that fails to accommodate that condition?
In other words, is it a violation of the duty to have a safe workplace once you know that your employee has got PTSD to treat them in a way that generates stress by grabbing papers and approaching them in a small workplace?
Right, and I suppose there could be a scenario where that would be true, but I would also point out that there are certain kinds of cases that are precluded from this kind of a tort claim, and they are places where there are workplace disputes. I mean, certainly there was a contentious relationship between Mr. Young and his supervisor, some of which he initiated, I think, if you look at the emails. But these workplace disputes where people aren't getting along, those are generally pulled out of the negligent infliction category of claims. And I would also point out that I think one of the things he has to prove, and he hasn't done it, is that he has presented a claim where There is no possible way that it could be considered part of his workplace injury. And I agree that the facts are somewhat different than other cases where something happens right away, but the law clearly provides for someone like Mr. Young, who discovers a new injury that wasn't apparent at the time of the incident back in 2010, to come forward later and say, boy, my condition has been aggravated, and it happened based on this terrible thing that happened to me back in 2010. The law allows him to do that. But more importantly, I think the case law suggests that once you raise that claim, one of the elements of your negligent infliction claim has to be a showing that that injury isn't covered by the Industrial Insurance Act. And I don't think that he's met that burden at all.
So if Mr. Young had gone back to L&I and said, look, Mr. Williams' ongoing behavior has aggravated my PTSD symptoms, he would have been entitled to relief under the Industrial Insurance Act?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Because those are different incidents, and I think that's what you're getting at. I'm talking about the diagnosable condition, the PTSD, and you're talking about events that happened after that. So I understand that,
so
and we agree.
The Industrial Insurance Act doesn't provide a remedy for the distress that, or the aggravation that occurs because of Mr. Williams' subsequent conduct.
I agree.
So why isn't there some tort law remedy available?
Well, there is a tort law remedy available if you can make out the elements of the claim. And as you noted earlier in your remarks, I think there's all of those things have all been offered as a basis for his discrimination claim, and there are no separate facts. And there are cases that suggest when you have no separate facts, in fact, there's even a federal decision that I cited to you that says you have to plead separate facts to support your claim under Washington law. And I think the plaintiff has, or the appellant has conceded here that there are no distinctions, that the facts that support this discrimination and the retaliation claim and the hostile work environment claim are also part of the negligent infliction facts, so that they aren't separate and distinct. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Thank you. Moving along briefly to the issue of whether or not there was evidence of race-based discrimination, we've had a lot of discussion, and I understand the panel's very familiar with the shifting burden in the law here, but I think this really is a case where we don't have any direct evidence. We don't have racial slurs or anything like that in this case between Mr. Williams.
Well, you don't need direct evidence. You can have circumstantial evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would suggest that there isn't even any circumstantial evidence here. What Mr. Young presented to us was his belief that his supervisor was an Uncle Tom, and that he was attempting to curry favor with other people in management, and that explains his conduct, and that it is because of Mr. Young's race that he was treated the way he was. And he's certainly entitled to that opinion, but I think it requires facts. And there were no facts presented to support that belief that he was being disfavored by Uncle Tom. What we provided to the court and what the court considered were facts suggesting that the opposite was true, that Mr. Williams, in fact, supported his African-American peer who sought to be reclassified to a higher level of pay, not once but twice. There was simply no evidence that the conflict that existed between the two of them had anything whatever to do with race. Again, I think it can be true that people don't get along at work, but it doesn't give rise to a discrimination claim, and there really isn't any evidence to make out that prima facie element, even with circumstantial evidence. And then even if we thought that there was circumstantial evidence to support that claim, where is the evidence of pretext here? We don't have a case where he was given a false reason for something that happened to him. We don't have a case like...
Do you have to have pretext evidence? Or is it, I read the Scrivener case. Even after you've done your pretext analysis, you still ask the bottom line question. Could a rational juror find that an improper reason was a substantial factor in the employment decision?
I've been puzzling over that question since the last time you asked it, actually. And I think my answer is, I think, yes, the court gets to ask that question, but I still think that analysis includes whether or not there's evidence of pretext. If we look at the shifting burden analysis, that's how we get to dismissal. But in the end, I think what the court does under Hill versus BCTI is look at the quality of the evidence. I mean, after all, they adopted the Reeves versus Sanderson U.S. Supreme Court case, where we look at whether it's weak weak evidence.
And that's the peculiarity, because Hill basically seems to say that we are applying what is essentially the federal summary judgment standard in employment law cases in Washington. The Washington Supreme Court has never expressly said that. Mm-hmm. That seems to be what's happening. Rather than just showing that there is some genuine issue of material fact, you really have to show that a rational juror could rule for the plaintiff before you survive summary judgment.
Yes, and I think that's part of, I mean, I think that is the end.
Do you think that's the law in Washington?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and I think that because it says so in the Hill case, and then I guess I would have to repeat what some other people have said. If we didn't go through this analysis and ask that important question, I think we'd be carving out a different standard for employment law Rule 56 motions than for other kinds of cases, and I don't think that our Supreme Court has said that we can do that. I understand that there may not always be direct evidence of discriminatory conduct, but the law has provided us with lots of ways to get there without that direct proof.
But in no other summary judgment context do we say, could a rational juror rule for the losing party in the summary judgment motion? We simply ask, is there a genuine issue of material fact? And we stop right there. And Hill doesn't say that's where we stop.
Well, Your Honor, I can't pretend to speak for all the other areas of law. I'm just not qualified to do that. I can only say what I understand the law to be based on the discrimination cases that I've read, and you may be correct that this is the only time that specific statement comes up in a case, but it does come up. Thank you. We ask for the court to affirm the trial court in all respects.
Thank you.
Just to get back to the negligent infliction claim and the predicate facts and whether it has to be a single traumatic event. And the county has misstated the relevant DSM-IV criteria, which states specifically, and I've cited that at clerk's papers 993 to 994, which is, I believe, the section quoted by his treating therapist, that the person must have experienced an event or events that threatened his physical integrity or self, or so it's not a single trauma that requires a PTSD diagnosis. With respect to the race discrimination claims, I think the central issue in this case, unlike some of the cases we've heard already about, is that Mr. Young has articulated a pattern of different treatment from some of his similarly situated coworkers, and those that the county has drawn on to compare his conduct with are not similarly situated. They're from all other sections of the county's facilities management division and not people who reported to the same supervisors. So, for example, one of the most compelling facts, and that's in Mr. Williams' own declaration, is that he believes he perceives some misconduct on the part of one of Mr. Young's Caucasian peers, Matthew Burke, but he did not use the same aggressive referral to investigation that he did with Mr. Young's behavior. When Mr. Young acted in a way that he found unsatisfactory, whether it was because he challenged his authority or whether he engaged in conduct where he was out of the office or some other conduct, Mr. Young was immediately referred into an investigative process, and that appeared to occur over a repeated series of times, even when the county HR staff was not able to substantiate the basis for that proposed investigation. And that kind of evidence is evidence of pretext in terms of whether there's a real, true factual basis for the challenged actions. And the investigations in this case, you know, became increasingly more severe after Mr. Young began to complain about Mr. Williams's conduct. And, you know, he would concede that it took him a while to reach the conclusion that some of his conduct, some of Williams's conduct, was motivated by his race. But when he began to see a distinct difference in how he was treated than the white peers who followed, who were hired under Mr. Williams's watch, he was forced to reach that conclusion that there was some reason. And he reported that to management, that Mr. Young not only did he use the phrase Uncle Tom, which he did not use in reporting to management. He used that as an example in questions from opposing counsel in his deposition. But he referred to the fact that he felt that Mr. Williams had difficulty or favored white employees because he was uncomfortable with his own race. And this was evident in the treatment that he experienced, and it was evident even more so after he complained of the conduct. The investigations, one of the most telling examples of that was the referral and discipline that he was issued related to his exempt status and abusing his time when the entire exempt workforce within that division was later cautioned and reminded that they were also perceived widely as not adhering to the same schedule or the regular schedules that they were allegedly instructed to conform to. And only Mr. Young was subject to discipline over those issues. All the other attendance examples given by the county are non-exempt employees. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, our final case this morning will be Grogan versus Seattle Bank.